Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Talking Markets podcast series here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. For today, we will spend some time examining the current market and macro environment, talk a bit about asset allocation, including the role that real assets can play in a portfolio today. Joining us for the conversation, glad to welcome from our partners at Northern Trust Asset Management, Peter Wilkie. Peter Wilkie serves as head of tactical asset allocation and as head of tactical asset allocation at Northern Trust Asset Management. Peter is responsible for the research and development of innovative investment strategies for the firm's tactical asset allocation initiatives. With that, Peter, great to have you here on the mic. Thank you for dropping by and for spending some time with our listeners and our clients of UBS here on the Talking Markets podcast.
Hi, Dan. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Absolutely. So topical that you're joining us, just given the current geopolitical environment, remains quite fluid. We've been tracking these developments over the past few weeks. They've been having a real impact to markets and assets. I'm curious, Peter, to what extent and perhaps how have geopolitics recently impacted your investment outlook?
Yeah, so Dan, the topic of geopolitics comes up in every client conversation. And, you know, we've been highlighting this to clients for many, many years that we think you should look at geopolitical events through a lens of what is the impact on growth and inflation, and also think about, you know, what regions, countries, or sectors are most impacted. And it had a significant impact on our investment outlook. And the way I would describe it usually, again, based on the last couple of years, is think about geopolitical shocks and events in three stages. There's the first stage, which is the shock. And often in the first, you know, day or two, it's more about how markets are positioned going into this event. So it's very important not to overinterpret market moves in the first day or two. But then in sort of phase two, as the geopolitical events unfold and there's sort of a timeline, we can talk about how long will this take. And in this case of the U.S.-Israel-Iran situation, we believe the timeline was about 2 months or so for intense fighting before phase three starts, which we're in right now, I think, which is about, you know, how will this be resolved in a longer term perspective and what will be the impact? So specifically in terms of our investment outlook, it made us less excited about the outlook for growth and equities in some regions. Country specific in Europe, but I would say broadly also Asia more negatively impacted than, for example, markets in North America. So that's how I would summarize sort of the impact that this conflict has had so far on our investment outlook.
Well, Peter, appreciate the insights as we're recording here on Thursday, April 9th. Again, remains a very fluid situation that we'll continue to monitor. I do want to turn focus a bit to monetary policy. Investors are also weighing the road ahead for monetary policy here in the U.S., this in the wake of the recent March FOMC meeting, whether further cuts or perhaps now even hikes can be expected through the balance of 2026. I'm curious, Peter, what's your take on what we've heard recently from the Fed, from Chairman Powell, and what do you believe will inform the Fed's decision-making the most from here?
So one thing that has changed, I would say, is, and that's also come through in the Fed minutes of their recent Fed meeting, is they really see still continued risk to the downside in the job market. So there was an extensive discussion on this topic in the last Fed meeting, but also in their public comments. You know, you hear a lot of concerns about, you know, how strong is the labor market. And also they've made it clear in their communication so far that they still see a disinflationary outlook over the long term. But what has shifted is with higher energy prices. Before we entered this year, there was sort of a clearer path for policymakers to say, okay, growth might not be very strong, maybe even a little bit weaker this year, and inflation after the tariff shock last year will start to trend lower, and that has been pushed out. So I think when we look at forecasts and our own expectations for inflation in the United States for next year, I think it's really a debate around, you know, the second half of 2027 when you could see inflation coming back to target. However, I do think the discussion on the labor market is front and center for the Fed. So this additional energy price shock also acts as a tax on consumers and on growth. So far, we haven't seen that in the data, but there's obviously enough history on how energy prices are passing through the U.S. economy. And I think that the discussion will continue. So on my assumption, I would say the Fed still has a couple of weeks until the April meeting and will probably continue to guide to markets that they feel comfortable where they are, which is maybe a little bit slightly tighter than some people would like to see it. But they're still in a very good spot to be patient. But I still believe that over the medium term, it's more likely we're going to see cuts as opposed to interest rate hikes.
Tying in real assets a bit and with that monetary policy outlook in mind, which you just shared with us, Peter, what are the implications of that to natural resources and other portfolio diversifiers like real estate or even infrastructure?
Yeah, I mean, it's a timely discussion because we publish a lot on the topic of portfolio allocation, forecasts for different asset classes, and the topic has come up a lot, which is, you know, what is an optimal portfolio and what is a resilient portfolio? And the portfolio resiliency question has come up a lot in the context of commodities, real estate, natural resources, equities. And the main reason for this, I think, is that over the years, markets have become less and less sensitive to natural resources. So the market cap, for example, in equities has gone up and up for technology and consumer businesses and industries, but has continued to trend down for materials, energy, natural resources, real estate. And the same thing actually happened in the fixed income market too. So unlike, say, the 1970s or even the 1920s, where there was plenty of natural resources, real estate, infrastructure, exposure and client portfolios and big indices, that's really shifted now, where clients are much more vulnerable to upside surprises and inflation and these shocks. And I think many clients and the ones that we speak actively about changing allocations, I was actually in an investment committee meeting on this topic yesterday where a decision was supported that we brought to the committee, which is increasing allocations to natural resources, equities and infrastructure and funding this out of a general equity position. And this is partly driven by our belief that this is a more resilient portfolio, but also believes that the expected return outlook for those asset classes are actually quite supportive of continued outperformance.
Now, Peter, in an increasingly geopolitically fragmented world, we touched on that a bit earlier in the conversation. I'm curious, from your perspective, what kind of role can precious metals, most notably gold, play in a portfolio today?
So gold has always been part of like being a financial asset for thousands of years. So there's a lot of experience on how to use gold as a diversifier. And it's often called the golden constant. And the reason people call it the golden constant is that if you look at financial returns in the really long run, gold has held its value over time. So the real return to gold over the really long run has been zero, but that's actually very good compared to paper assets and some other, riskier investments that have not delivered that constant return. But one thing that has changed and one thing that we emphasize to our clients as well is that gold has actually delivered an almost 7% return since it became a more free-flowing commodity since the 1970s when the U.S. came off the gold standard. So I would expect that in the long run, gold can continue to generate maybe 5 to 7% returns, but in a context of being a very good diversifier in a world where certain emerging markets, central banks and corporations in particular want to diversify away from accumulating more fixed income assets, in particular in the developed world. So we've seen this a lot in our client base that are more also, for example, central banks, official institutions that can't invest in equities, but they want to own risk assets and diversify. So for them, gold is a great way to get exposure to a diversified asset that is also no one's liability. That is an important aspect of why gold is a unique asset. What is tricky, I think, for our clients is also to understand how to size the position in the portfolio. And that's a really tough conversation sometimes. We've done a lot of research on this topic, and it really depends on, you know, how sensitive you are to drawdown risk and how volatile you want your portfolio to be. that what was interesting to me is when you look at the gold market and look at gold allocations, they really help at times of sovereign stress a lot. So if you're concerned about, you know, sovereign markets coming more under pressure over the next few years or decades based on higher deficits, gold obviously has had a history of protecting well against currency debasement, but also sovereign default. So I think from that perspective, you know, I've seen and I've done work for clients where the suggested allocations can be somewhere between 2 and 5%.
Now, if we look outside of precious metals for a few moments and the mining industry, what role, Peter, do energy and agriculture investments play in a portfolio? What have you been seeing there?
So they also play an important role, and it's the bigger picture of, you know, you don't want to just diversify in real assets and just gold, for example. Even if it's become, you know, such a big asset class, almost a third of the size of equities, you do want to take into account the other really large sectors. And for generations, energy and agriculture are huge sectors in every economy. But they often, as I mentioned before as well, they've become a smaller part of a portfolio. And I think for clients, it's important to embrace higher allocations in a diversified fashion. And one thing that we do also emphasize is you've got to be precise. So we do think it's important to sit more at the upstream part of this process. So energy or agricultural companies that actually have control over the supply and have control over what they do with the finished product or the mined product, or also in the case of energy, control over the distribution capabilities as well. I think that leans itself towards owning energy more in the form of equities. The same thing on the agricultural side. There are agriculturally exposed companies that have done a great job over time to generate shareholder value. So my preference personally is just to be more involved in equity-related investments in energy and agriculture as opposed to investing directly, say, in crude oil or investing directly in corn and soybean futures. That's a different investment. So my preference right now would be more on the equity-related side of the energy agricultural complex.
Now, just in terms of risk considerations when it comes to real assets, whether it be a precious metals, other forms of investments, what's important for investors to know and what might be top of mind for you at the moment, Peter?
So one of the things, and that's like an evergreen comment, is the biggest thing for investors is to fear themselves. And what I mean by that is you really need to understand your portfolio and your biases. So when you see a crisis in markets like recently, really have a conversation with your advisor on what are the resilient parts of your portfolio. And if you are somewhat unhappy with performance in the last few weeks and you felt the portfolio didn't hold up as well as expected, that's a great starting point to say, okay, which positions do I want to add to? So it's really about, you know, going into your portfolio and understanding each of the positions. The thing that I highlight to many clients as well is stay away from complexity. This outlook right now, the world, the innovation that we're seeing in some sectors, I would personally be skeptical of highly complex investments. So when you sit down with your UBS advisor, for example, just make sure that you really understand the portfolio and why certain assets have gone up and down, understanding what you're invested in and also challenging appropriately. Those are the most important things in personal finance, as well as, you know, for the most sophisticated institutional investors. The investors that I admire a lot that have done really well, they often have a really good clarity on process and philosophy and understand their portfolio really well.
Well, Peter, some valuable guidance there when it comes to performing your due diligence and having an investment process in place. So thank you for that. Before we close out today, Peter, and thank you for covering the ground that you did with our listeners, our clients, any final thoughts, takeaways, or anything you would like to reinforce to our listeners today?
So I would still reinforce a key topic that we've talked about in every question now, Dan, which is the topic of diversification. So really asking yourself, you know, what part of my portfolio is driven by what's happening in the Middle East right now? What part of my portfolio is driven by technology innovation? What part of my portfolio is driven by potentially defaults in some areas? So it's really about you know, engaging with your portfolio, being on top of what's happening in markets, but also being disciplined. Markets can be robust and resilient. So just one thought that I thought is really worth highlighting, despite all of the you know, geopolitical risks and some of the chaos we've seen, the U.S. equity market is still priced off earnings. And earnings have actually been revised up over the last 4 to 6 weeks. So there is something also broader happening at the equity market that sometimes people forget about when there's just one big global event unfolding in front of us. So the other thing I would point out is that really, you know, not always looking at the top three stories that are in markets, but looking a little bit deeper, looking off the beaten path, and really trying to also use areas of weakness and days, weeks of weakness to add to positions that really make good long-term investments. I think that's a really good, you know, just principle for investors to be aware of and to implement in their portfolios.
Well, Peter, you've been very generous with your time. A pleasure speaking with you, and thank you for sharing your investment insights and guidance with our listeners, our clients here on the Talking Markets podcast. Thank you again for dropping by today, Peter. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Dan.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC.